Do you think people will vote for me?
Heck yes, I'd vote for you.
Like, what are my skills?
Well, you have a sweet bike, and you're really good at hooking up with chicks. Plus, you're like the only guy at school who has a mustache.
That's true.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
If you vote for me, all of your wildest dreams will come true.
Now, I thought it was interesting. I'm going to kiss your ass here a little bit again because, you know, the whole story of Roswell has been just beaten to death so many times. And you here, Nick Redfern, you've introduced two new theories to the Roswell crash in the last decade. You've got the bodies and body snatchers in the desert theory. And then in this book, there's a whole nother idea that, you know, that this is alchemical material that is sprinkled in the New Mexico desert by the nefarious dark forces, if you will. So, I mean, I'm not. There's no real question behind this, in a sense, just sort of a celebration that you're adding some new stuff to the Roswell story.
Well, yeah, I mean, Roswell, you know, the biggest problem about Roswell isn't, you know, the fact that we have one or two theories suggesting something strange happened. It's that we have so many theories, you know, and it's kind of like when you get to saturation point, then it becomes difficult to know what the truth is. And, you know, you mentioned I wrote a book called Body Snatchers in the Desert back in 2005, which was basically, you know, a study of the idea of was Roswell a military experiment, you know, that went wrong and it was covered up because it was sort of a dubious sort of high altitude experiment using people. But the Collins elite had what I would actually say is like a unique approach, which I truthfully never ever contemplated or considered. They viewed Roswell as like a Trojan horse. They don't believe anything literally crashed in the form of an accident at Roswell. They believed it was like a deliberately staged event. And they believe that basically, as the literal interpretation, that demons don't have a literal form. You know, that, a lot of people are surprised about this, but you know, the official story, or not the official story, but you know, the religious view is that, you know, demons are without form. Although, you know, some people believe they can take on sort of a physical appearance, if you like.
Right.
But the Collins elite came to believe that these entities were able to sort of alchemically almost manipulate matter. So, you know, they would pluck matter and created the so-called memory metal found at Roswell. And as you point out, like kind of literally sprinkled it onto the New Mexico desert floor to create the image in our minds of a crash. And they believe that they did the same thing with the bodies. They believe that the bodies never lived. You know, they were almost like, they were dummies, but not crash test dummies. They were like dummies made of, you know, what we would call flesh, blood, bone, DNA. But again, which had been sort of alchemically manipulated. Kind of like, you know, if you take the imagery of like a jackalope, you know, a jackalope's this sort of created creature, you know, you can buy in stores that never really lived, but it's made up of bone, blood, DNA, etc.
Right.
You know, but it's taken from different animals. They kind of believe that. The idea that, you know, that these were constructed life forms designed to lull the U.S. military into a false sense of security that vulnerable aliens had crashed, you know, like a typical Trojan horse scenario. Now, as I said, what's interesting is that Jack Parsons tried to himself conjure up one of these creatures known as a homunculus, where it's basically like a manufactured life form that, you know, you instill life in it, but it never really lived, so to speak.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that one of Parsons' colleagues, who was almost a father figure to him, named Theodore von Karman, who also in a roundabout way was linked with manufactured life forms. Von Karman had a relative hundreds of years ago who was obsessed with golems. You know, the golem in, you know, Jewish traditions, again, is like this manufactured creature. And the fact that von Karman, you know, believed in the golem story, you know, is an adherent of the story. And he was working with Jack Parsons, who was trying to conjure up or create manufactured life forms. And then we find the Collins elite thinks that the, you know, the bodies found at Roswell were manufactured life forms. You know, we see another strand here as well. And what's even more interesting is that a guy who was sort of not so much an ally, but a semi-friendly rival of Parsons was Robert Goddard, who moved his rocket programs to Roswell. And Jack Parsons, in the late 30s, early 40s, actually went out to Roswell to discuss rocketry with Goddard. So, you know, we have Parsons actually out at Roswell, which, you know, again, takes the story to an even deeper level, if you like.
Hmm. Now, in the, you know, I guess you could say in the mythos of the history of ufology, where do you think, and maybe this, again, maybe this came up with the guys from the Collins Elite, maybe it didn't, but I'm sure, you've thought about this, I hope. You know, where, I guess, what's the situation, what's the relationship between the Collins Elite and whatever faction would be the MJ-12? Whether we, you know, obviously may not go by that name, but there seems to be an idea that there's a government, you know, group looking at UFOs. What was the relationship between those two potential groups?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a very good question, Tim, because it's important we understand sort of the nature of this group. You know, I think what I got pretty quickly, and I think is absolutely correct, is that this isn't some sort of all-powerful CIA-type agency, or even something like MJ-12. You know, the Collins Elite is not the group that is sitting on the big secret. I mean, they talk about Roswell. You know, a lot of the material, I reproduce sort of the text of an intriguing, but, you know, a document that isn't ultimately verifiable yet. It didn't surface through the Freedom of Information Act. A lot of the material they talk about in there, you know, their reference section is open source literature, like the Moore Berlitz book on the Roswell incident, you know, or Kevin Randall's books, etc. The Collins Elite, to me, don't come across like, you know, the guys who are sitting on the big secret. They were like one or two levels down. Mm-hmm. You know, they were sort of a think tank group that, okay, there may be somebody who's really sitting on a big secret, but we want to get other people's inputs as well in case, you know, the all-powerful group have actually got it wrong. And so the Collins Elite seemed to be like a second or third tier type think tank that had access to some insider secrets. That's clear, you know, because they clearly reference a number of reports on Roswell that, if they are real, remain classified and go far beyond balloons and crash test dummies. But they don't seem to have been cleared to have actually seen the bodies or handled the wreckage. You know, they got information that they were cleared to access to a certain degree. And they do come across more like a funded think tank rather than the guys pulling the strings, you know, and I think that's an important factor, that, you know, that's how government agencies work. You know, all the work isn't done by, you know, the top dog, so to speak, you know, the top dog sort of assigns programs and projects to sort of sub-projects, and they aren't always cleared to know why they're collecting the information they're being asked to collect or ordered to collect. And I think that applies here, that the Collins Elite knew a great deal that we don't know. There's no doubt about that. And they uncovered a lot of data that, you know, we don't have access to. But it was passed, I think, further up the chain, and they may not even have known what was done with it, you know.
Right, right. I think you, in the part you're talking about that references the open source text, I think even in that, it's a piece written by someone in the Collins Elite, and it sounds like they're sort of bemoaning some group above them that has like an indecipherable, like four letter name that we, you know, is just like four letters.
No, you're absolutely right. I actually talk about this a couple of times when, you know, they were interested in abductions. They felt abductions were like a holographic imagery instilled in the mind of the witness to try and convince, you know, that they'd been abducted by aliens, but it was like a blanketing of the population, of almost like a Matrix-type insertion into people's minds with no physical reality to it. And they were bemoaning the fact that, well, we need more funding to investigate this. You know, if they were the top dog, they wouldn't be complaining that, you know, our abduction project needs to be revamped and kick-started, you know. So, again, I see several strands like that throughout the book. You know, it's not all the time, but consistently from 52, when they sort of pretty much really kicked off formally, through the 80s, when the abduction project kicked off big time, or to a larger degree, and then with Roswell, there are inferences in all these different aspects where they were like, we need more money, we need more funding, why is this group, you know, getting access to this and we're not, you know. And to me, that makes the story more credible. You know, if they were claiming to know the answers to everything and being the top thing, I'd be like, well, this is just too smoothly presented to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But having a think tank group that actually was complaining about funding and budgets and believing there was people above them who knew more, that is the way government works. And that made it, you know, come across to me as far more believable and acceptable, you know, that it wasn't some sort of disinformation ploy or whatever.
Yeah. And again, to sort of like strip the religious connotations away from the story in a sense, but also to look at what the story, the root of the story, if you will, I thought it was really troubling and interesting that this whole thing sort of hinges on the harvesting of souls. Because, and even you point out in the book that it's like impossible to really get to the bottom of what the soul is. It's like this intangible thing that great minds throughout history have tried to elucidate more. But, and I've heard this theory endlessly, really, about the harvesting of souls. So it sounds like there must be something, I don't know, not necessarily to the idea of the harvesting of souls, but there's got to be something going on that is at the root of this. Do you know what I mean? It feels, it resonates.
Yeah, I mean, this actually sort of eerily, in a way, parallels, you know, the Matrix saga. You know, in the movies, you know, the real world that we think we all live in, you know, when we get stuck in traffic or watch TV, you know, it's like an image, you know, it's a dream, but a highly sophisticated dream. And really, we're all, millions of us or billions of us, you know, we're all in these pods making electricity for the machines in the Matrix. You know, that's the basic theme of the movie or the movies. And the Collins elite had a similar scenario. They believe that the reason why, you know, these entities have never sort of landed on the White House lawn or destroyed us is because they don't want to do either. They want to maintain us. The Collins elite kind of viewed us as like a herd, you know, like the cattle. And the idea is that, you know, the cattle blissfully eat and munch the grass in the fields, you know, and the farmer feeds them. And as far as they're concerned, he's their friend, you know.
Yeah.
He brings food and water every day and gives them somewhere to sleep at night. But then the day comes, you know, when they're taken away and they're slaughtered for food, you know, and then their eyes are open as to what their fate is. Well, the Collins elite believed that the earth was like that. It was like a huge farm. We were the herd. And that when we get taken, you know, at the point of death, what happens, they believe, was that these entities... Now, this isn't in the Bible, I should stress this. The Collins elite actually sort of mutated some of the old beliefs and came up with their own ideas based on the stuff that they said they uncovered as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that these entities, you know, that some people call demons, literally live on soul energy. So, in other words, they want to maintain the human race until a point where the biblical prophecies have to be fulfilled regardless. But they viewed it that, you know, they take energy as a food source from the human soul. And so, in other words, we're harvested, you know. When we die, it's the equivalent to the cows being taken to the slaughterhouse, you know. We're harvested for our souls. And it was described as like a, you know, almost like a scientific situation, you know, where these sort of entire soul factories almost, you know, in some other realm of existence. And that is probably the one thing, you know, more than anything else in the book, really does sort of disturb people, you know, the idea that the planet is like a farm, you know. But what's interesting is that there probably aren't hardly any abduction researchers who haven't been told this by at least more than a handful of abductees, you know. John Mack talked about it a lot. Whitley Strieber did. You know, Whitley Strieber said that some of the entities, or one of the entities he conversed with or was confronted with, was told, you know, we recycle souls. You know, Bob Lazar said, you know, the files he supposedly read at Area 51 described us as containers. You know, the idea that we were just the container for something more important. You know, and if that is true, it's kind of like it'd be kind of really ironic, you know, if we're just some huge farm, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, you wonder if it's like, you know, if the soul's like a floppy disk and it just goes through the human body and you die and whatever these things are, take it and eat all the memory, maybe that's what powers them, and then they just stick a fresh, you know, they take all the stuff off the disk, put it back in the next person, and, you know, it's spooky. Yeah. It's just the whole thing.
Well, it is. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, you know, there's they admitted this was a theory, but, you know, it was a theory born out of the fact that a considerable number of people in the abduction field, regardless of how much they promote it or not, many of them do have those type of stories. You know, I cite pretty much all the famous, well-known abductees in that particular chapter of the book, where they'd all, you know, pretty much got stories along those lines. Whether they accepted them or not, it's a different thing, but abductees were telling them that, you know, they felt these things were sort of literally stealing their soul, you know, like a psychic vampire or something like that.
Yeah, it's spooky. You know, what I really found interesting about this book, too, I really couldn't put it down and was just fascinated by it, because it has so many twists on the classic UFO milieu. There's, the Roswell thing we talked about, and then later on in the book, you know, this thing with My Labs, which is military abductions, which is a whole new branch, you could say, of abduction research that posits the idea that the government is following up alien abductions with their own abductions to, I guess, as I said to Melinda Leslie a long time ago, reverse engineer these abductees to figure out what they saw and everything. And then as you put forward in the book, the Collins elite looked at My Labs and couldn't come up with anything to prove them within the secret confines of the government, if you will, and then concluded that the My Labs are also part of this grand illusion, which is insane.
Yeah, they kind of concluded that the whole, you know, everything from My Labs to the black helicopters and abductions, that it was all part of like a massively sophisticated sort of simulation, you know, projected into the mind of the person while they slept or whatever, you know, and that it was being deliberately done all across the nation or the world to sort of promote and prompt, you know, the meme idea of what alien abductions are supposed to be, you know, get people. So everybody, and arguably, you know, whether people believe it or not, everybody knows what the term alien abduction means today. That's a fact. You know, people do. You could ask them in England, France, Germany, Australia, America, Canada, what's an alien abduction scenario, and they would tell you. You know, so arguably that meme has spread. But yeah, it was weird that the Collins elite basically said, well, you know, we've got this abduction group, and all we've got is like telephones, resources to review books, and, you know, a few documents or whatever. Yet there's this other group got access to helicopters and underground bases in fortified desert locations, and the government said, well, no, we're not doing that. And when the Collins elite themselves went looking, they couldn't find anything. And then they came to this idea, well, maybe this is all part of the simulation as well, you know, and there is no My Lab, you know, it's all part of this entire ruse.
Yeah, it's like I said, so many twists on the UFO story that as you're going along, it makes you take a whole other look at this entire phenomenon, which is
The interesting thing is as well that, you know, even if we take, you know, people say, well, how do we know this isn't disinformation? One of the reasons why I think it isn't is because we can actually find evidence of where stories like this have surfaced before, but you can take them sort of with new light and new appreciation with the Collins elite angle. For example, in 1973, there was a very famous UFO encounter at a place called Mansfield, Ohio, involving a helicopter crew piloted by a captain named Captain Coyne, where they had an extremely close encounter with a UFO as they were in the skies, and it affected the helicopter's engines, all sorts of stuff. Very famous case. And in the aftermath, the crew reported how, you know, they get these weird phone calls from the Pentagon asking if they'd had any dreams, weird dreams about leaving their body or dying and feeling their soul leaving the body. You know, this is the sort of stuff that the Collins elite were heavily influenced by and interested in. And these guys went on record years ago saying, you know, we got these weird phone calls of people asking us about soul separation in relation to this UFO event. Which sounds, although they weren't told, you know, they were from the Collins elite, but that sounds exactly like what that group would have been doing then. So.
Yeah, yeah, very weird. Now, I'm dying to know, because the book came out a couple of years ago, or maybe about 18 months ago or so, have you learned anything more? Have more people come forward? I mean, is there any sort of general update on this Collins elite research? Because, you know, up until this book came out, you know, I talk about you adding two new theories to the Roswell crash. I mean, you've added a whole new batch of characters, in a sense. You've sort of added a new MJ-12, as we already kind of talked about. So, I mean, this thing could go on forever looking at this group.
Yeah, I mean, certain things have come forward. I mean, for example, a few more corroborative stories like the Captain Coyne one, you know, where things I hadn't thought about, you know, where somebody pointed out, you know, well, this sounds like these guys as well, that kind of thing. I also got hold of some documents talking about how the CIA back in the 50s were heavily researching Ouija boards. One of the people the Collins elite was interested in was a contactee named George Hunt Williamson, who claimed to have contacted aliens by Ouija boards. Now we find in that very same area the CIA was interested in Ouija boards. You know, I've got a few things like that. And I've got a few more revelations, no pun intended, from the people I previously interviewed. But unfortunately, now whether this, you know, should be viewed suspiciously as, you know, sort of a manipulation or not, I don't know, but no more members of the group have come forward. Now, you know, whether that means this was like a testing of the waters and there's been a decision taken not to take it any further, or, you know, for all I know, maybe they've gone on to somebody else, you know, to, and next week, you know, there's going to be a new book that nobody's been told about because it's been kept under wraps. Do you know what I mean? And somebody else has spoken to members of the group. You know, I think that's a possibility. So, you know, the very fact that, because this story, I got it from Ray Beauchamp, and it wasn't like one that was spoon-fed to me. It was one I sort of stumbled on, and then somebody said, well, okay, you know, we'll share a few things. It wasn't like, you know, I discovered all this stuff hidden away in some archive. So I think, in many respects, you know, the good argument can be made they were the ones pulling the strings, which I have to admit is true. You know, this wasn't a case of me, unfortunately, being in control of the situation. It was the exact opposite. You know, and that relates to how the data was given to me as well. So I think that possibly explains, you know, why I've made some headway in some areas. In other ways, unfortunately, I haven't. You know, I wish I could say I'm in the position to write Final Events 2, but I'm not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could. You know, I wish I could add another 100 pages to the Parsons angle, or to the Adamski angle, or to the Soul angle, but I can't. I've got snippets. But it wouldn't surprise me because, you know, they spoke to Ray Beauchamp in 91. They corresponded, or elements of them corresponded with Linda Howe in, I think it was 94 or 93. And then I had this sort of contact, 2009, 2010, that era, 2008. And so for that reason, I think, you know, there could well be other people who are going to take it to another level.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a lot of this is tested in the water to see what the response is, you know, and, so there's been snippets, but nothing where I wish I could say there's been some huge thing. There hasn't, unfortunately. So.
Yeah. No, I was just, well, I guess to piggyback on that, I mean, the UFO field is notorious for its tunnel vision on the nature of UFOs. So what was the reaction to this book? Because I can imagine a lot of people were like, what are you doing? You know, all this other stuff.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems, a lot of people made the mistake, and it was primarily those who hadn't read the book. They were assuming that I'd had some sort of overnight, you know...
Conversion,
that's a good word, yeah. Literally, and I was promoting this theory. That was the first mistake a lot of people made. Now, what I was doing, I was promoting the story of the group, because it is a fascinating story. You know, I'm not just saying that as the author. You know, a think tank paid and funded to look at the idea that the UFO phenomenon has demonic origins is a story worth telling.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's what I did. So a lot of people made the mistake of criticizing it because they were saying, well, how can you say this when we don't know that there's no evidence for it? And I said, well, hang on, I'm not saying it. I'm relating how this group came to believe that. And the other response was, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, this is fear-mongering, which to an extent, you know, I'm not fear-mongering, but I'm relating stuff that I'll be the first to admit can instill fear in people.
Yeah.
You know, but just because it can instill fear and it's controversial and can worry a lot of people, that's for me not enough reason to bury it.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, well, okay, if it's true or not, but if it is true, well, it's better that we know. You know, maybe we can do something about it.
Right.
You know, regardless of whether these things are literally demonic or not, if there is some connection with the human soul and it becomes an energy source, maybe there is a way to defeat it. And if there is, we should know. So there were people who actually criticized me. You know, ironic, these are people in the UFO field who believe the government's hiding the truth. And they're saying to me, well, Nick, it might have been better if you've hidden the story. You know,
what?
That's one
ridiculous.
Of the biggest ironies. That's one of the biggest ironies of all, that there were people who were saying you should have acted with self-censorship because it's too reckless and dangerous a story to tell, whether true or not. And I was like, well, basically, you know, off. And I'm not sure I can say that on air, so I left it out, but we all know what the word was.
Exactly, yeah. You can say it, but it's all right.
Yeah, all right. I told them, fuck off. You know, because it was like, the last thing the UFO community should be doing with any theory is engaging in self-censorship. You know, that's just ridiculous. So there were things like that. And a lot of people misunderstood, you know, they were suspicious even sometimes. Well, how did you get the story? Why was it given to you? Not realizing that it wasn't given to me. Had I not approached Ray Beauchamp about the Rendlesham thing, and then Ray said, well, yeah, these guys did work on Rendlesham, but they were also involved in this other stuff. You know, had it not been for the Rendlesham angle, I would be none the wiser than anybody else. Mm. You know, it was just pure luck and chance that Ray Beauchamp opened the door, so to speak, that allowed me to dig into this further. So, you know, it was a case of just being in the right place at the right time. And people loudly wanted to know, you know, oh, well, how did Nick know this? You know, this has got to be disinformation because they approached him to get this story out knowing he's an author. No, nobody approached me. I went looking, you know, which is a very different angle.
Exactly.
You know, I only went looking thanks to Ray being willing to speak to me. So.
Well, it's
so things like that happen. But, I mean, it gives you a good appreciation of what, in alternative circumstances, what you can actually find occur in the UFO field, which you never really anticipated would have happened, you know.
Yeah, and it's ironic because, again, well, no pun intended, the government is demonized by the people in the UFO community. But, yeah, I know, waka waka. But then you look at the events of this story, and it's like the government has more of an open mind about the UFO phenomenon than the UFO research community does, because they're looking at the demon thing with an open mind.
Well, this is one of the biggest ironies. A lot of people forget that government agencies, or the government as a generic body, if you like, mm-hmm. has actually addressed numerous theories, far more than the UFO community, for the most part, either entertains the idea. You know, on the one hand, you have the ETH believers. On the other hand, you have the debunkers who say it's weather balloons or whatever. But the government, over the years, has looked at the UFO angle, the secret weapon angle, that's reflected in early FBI files, the Russian angle, that was first addressed, you know, by a panicked military in the summer of 47. The Department of Commerce's Weather Bureau looked at ball lightning in the 40s. The British Ministry of Defence looked at plasmas, you know, with this Condine project. The extraterrestrial angle has been addressed. The Robertson panel of the CIA was less interested in what UFOs were and more how the Russians might exploit it for propaganda purposes. You know, that's like seven or eight theories, many of a very intriguing and alternative nature, addressed by government. You know, that's sort of more refreshing than an open-minded than those of us in the UFO field,
right.
You know. But what this points out to, I think, is that the governments, despite what we think, may actually not really have all the answers. You know, if there was a unified single UFO program that had all the answers, there wouldn't be government agencies looking at weather balloons, at ball lightning, you know, propaganda programs, mogul balloons, you know, aliens, plasmas, et cetera, et cetera. There would be one program looking at one angle, you know. So this suggests that this gives us some sort of light at the end of the tunnel that maybe this sort of demonic theory isn't the doomsday scenario that many people might think it is, because that is just one of at least 10 I can think of theories that have been addressed by various think tanks within government, you know. So I think that gives us some hope, you know. And I think the big flaw was interpreting potential other realms where these things could come from as a literal demonic hell, which does frighten a lot of people, you know, in a country like America, which is heavily Christian-based, you know, it's... It does frighten people, but, you know, should we be frightened of that? Well, yeah. Should we be frightened if it's just another realm that can be explained scientifically? Then maybe not, you know. So.
Right, right. And to sort of continue that theme of the scariness of it all is that, you know, towards the end of the book, it's discussed how, you know, the Collins elite and elements within the government sort of come up with this idea to sort of lock down the United States and
Yeah, like a feudal religious...
Right, right.
Testimony. Yeah, the basic scenario they had of this was the idea of... I don't know how they came to this conclusion. I never really got an answer to it. But they believed that belief in, you know, God, so to speak, that belief could actually hold these entities at bay. You know, not laser guns or weaponry, but belief or denial of them. Like, denial of them can hold them at bay is probably the easiest way to explain it. And they believe that the only way that the entire nation could be galvanized to have the strength of belief that was needed would be like a second coming. And if it didn't happen, it would have to be staged to convince, you know, everybody or 99% of the population that that's what it was. And then if belief was so deep, it would stand a chance of keeping these things at bay for however long was needed.
Right.
Now, people say, you know, that's just impossible. There's no way the government could stage a second coming. You know, but, I mean, one of the things that I pointed out that's actually surfaced since publication of the book are documents talking about how in the early 60s, the CIA actually planned for this over Cuba. They had a plan. I wish I had this in time to put it in the book, but they had a plan. And I have the documents on this now.
I think it might be in the. I think it might be mentioned in the. The pyramids and the Pentagon.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
I put it in the pyramids and the Pentagon. The scenario was that, you know, that back in the early 60s, they wanted to get rid of Fidel Castro from Cuba by any means possible. One of the plans the military had was to fake a second coming. The idea was to bring boats covertly under cover of night into the harbors off the coast of Cuba and project images of Jesus onto low-level clouds, and then have aircraft flying through the clouds with their engines muffled as much as possible and guys broadcasting messages saying, this is Jesus, in simple terms saying, this is Jesus, you know, I'm on the side of the United States, renounce your, you know, your allegiance to Fidel Castro and you won't burn in hell. That was basically the scenario. Now, of course, it was never undertaken because it was perceived as being just too difficult. You know, you've got to get the boats in without being blown up. You've got to have the low cloud cover. You've got to hope that the ruse doesn't go wrong. And it was just seen as just too problematic and one of these wacky projects. But it was talked about, planned, and discussed in a roundtable setting, which is exactly what the Collins elite said happened just a few years ago. But today, they're not talking about anything like that. They're talking about, like, sophisticated holograms, you know, to confuse whole masses of people, which is a very different scenario, you know, bringing boats in and kind of cinematic projection equipment and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the idea was, you know, to sort of instill religion more and more in the military and create it, you know, sort of almost like an Old Testament fear-based religion, you know, and I have to be the first to admit religion is playing a bigger and bigger role in the military and government, you know, and there's no doubt about that. And, you know, when religion begins to play more of a role in government, it becomes to play more of a dominating role, you know, and you could argue that some of the stuff that the people in the Collins elite said 5 years ago, we're actually now seeing, you know, sort of. It's like, I mean, nobody running for president in the U.S. today can do so without talking loudly about their religious beliefs.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what they believe at a religious level, but the very fact that they have to promote it demonstrates how significant a role and a growing role it's playing, where any candidate has to say, this is what I believe, you know, And it's going on more and more, you know.
Well,
some horrible indoctrination programs and intimidation in the military of people who aren't adhering to the idea that, you know, the war in the Middle East is basically, you know, the fight against good and evil. It's not, it's a war. It's not a battle, a supernatural battle between good and evil at all.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, that's the scary part that's sort of come out of this post-9/11 yeah. world. It's like, yeah. I mean, I'm no student of U.S. history, but I can't recall any sort of war that was so heavily based along religious lines than this whole thing that's
yeah,
going on
war.
Now.
It's a war, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a fight for the souls of the planet. You know, there are people who believe that, but that was never broadcast in the Second World War, the First World War, the Vietnam War. You know, it's being done now, and that, interestingly enough, ties in with a lot of what the Collins Elite was saying, that, you know, it's to instill fear, and the ultimate scenario that was discussed was like a lockdown of the nation to create like a feudal, dumbed-down society living in fear, but still living. That was the idea. The scenario was, well, you know, if it means the nation isn't what it was in terms of freedom, at least people are still alive. You know, it was sort of like the worst well-meaning scenario you could imagine. You know what I mean?
Right, right. It's like, well, we're going to survive, but in this horrible position. It's that, you know.
Yeah.
The whole book
yeah.
is full of scary.
Well, but, yeah.
scenarios.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you could also have some degree, a small amount of sympathy. You know, if it is true to any degree, you know, have some sympathy for the fact that, well, how can we tell people this, that the Earth's a farm?
Right.
You know, and our souls are basically the food, you know, and the earth is like the field and the barn, you know. And the soul is like the steak, you know, well done or rare. You know?
Right, right.
Which I hope isn't true. But
yeah, you know, I mean,
who can say, you know?
Yeah, it's scary stuff. Now, what about, obviously, this Collins Elite, they're like a think tank within the U.S., and we've long heard sort of ideas that, you know, really, even though there was this Cold War, that really the Russians and the Americans were kind of on board with this UFO thing, and they knew what was going on. This whole idea, I guess you could say, that you know, the big countries of the planet Earth are in the know on the UFO thing. Did they ever sort of give any indication as to what the Russians or the British intelligence agencies and governments might know about the demonic entity theory, if you will?
Well, yeah, I mean, what I'd say first, Tim, is that, you know, there's no doubt. You know, I don't believe all these theories that, you know, that the Cold War was a charade and that we were friends with the Russian secret all along. But what I do believe, and we know is a fact, is that when it suited them, agencies of opposing hostile nations did work together. You know, the CIA and the KGB did work occasionally on operations together where it was of mutual benefit. So, you know, I don't think we're ever friends as such with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. But grudgingly, they would work together, you know, if it was a threat facing both of them and they could wipe it out, you know, together,
right.
so to speak. And one of the things that we do know is that there were people within the British establishment and government that, you know, did follow a similar path. I mean, for example, Lord Hill Norton, you know, who was a big advocate of Rendlesham. You know, he had a lot of beliefs that went down this sort of occult pathway. You know, he was a good friend and ally to Gordon Crichton, the former editor of Flying Saucer Review, who was heavily into, you know, the demonic djinn, you know, Middle Eastern djinn type scenario, that it was all a UFO deception. There are a lot of people in the, you know, the British establishment who followed that same path. Now, because they were tied to the establishment, does that mean, you know, they could have been part of some quasi semi-official think tank similar to the Collins Elite? You know, they could have been. I have to admit, I've never found evidence of a official group in the Ministry of Defense in Britain or Russia or somewhere that was like, you know, the equivalent of Project Blue Book. I've never found anything like that. But I have found people high up in the British establishment that were interested in UFOs and did believe the occult aspect. So, you know, maybe they've had discussions and talks purely and simply because they're, you know, they're well connected to have those talks.
Yeah. The whole thing, it's very interesting. Like I said, it really adds a whole new layer to the entire history of the UFO phenomenon that I had never
considered. Still digging into it, you know, where I can. It's just kind of, you know, I'm hopeful that more data will come forward, but, you know, I do wonder if it's sort of a test in other waters and that a deliberate stance was taken where this is how far we're going to go for now, and then, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, did you ever hear from these guys, like, after the book came out or anything like that?
One or two of them, but a lot of them, it was like, you know, just didn't respond to emails, didn't respond to calls. You know, when I mailed copies of the books out, you know, to the addresses I'd got at least, you know, I only got sort of a limited response. And again, that's what makes me, it doesn't make me suspicious of the story, because if it was all disinformation, I don't think it would be so well constructed and more and believable in the sense of it being, you know, them complaining about budgets and whatever. You know, they would portray themselves as, we know this to be fact and we're this all-powerful group, you
right.
know, like MJ-12. They didn't come across like that. They came across more vulnerable, you know, and underfunded in some respects, which makes sense. So, but I do believe that, you know, things that people might take as suspicious as to how they kind of pretty much cut themselves off from me afterwards, I don't view that as suspicious. I really do think it was more like, okay, let's just sit back and see what the response is, you know. And then do we approach somebody else or do we go to somebody in the mainstream media? You know, I think that could be a possibility. You know, we have to remember that our community, the UFO community, is a relatively small one with like a hardcore of several thousand. In other words, although we're a hardcore of 3,000 or 4,000 UFO researchers, we're also a wide range of society, you know. You could have somebody who buys UFO books who's a scientist, somebody drives the school bus, you know, somebody's a cop, somebody works in Walmart. We're all across the board, which is good, you know, that we've got a good wide range of people. But if the Collins elite or somebody in government wanted to see what the response was to the book across the board, targeting the entire country would be difficult. Why not target our small community, which it knows is made up of variables from every walk of life, and see how they responded to it? Maybe that's what it was, like a psychological test, and use the UFO community as like a small version for when they need to sort of try and address what the country as a whole might think, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And what makes it, you know, makes me wonder if they think that they made a mistake in a sense, because, you know, kudos to you. Different UFO researchers out there might have taken this stuff and just presented it as fact, if you will, or,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, that's kind of the idea behind disinformation in a lot of ways. We're going to give you this story with the hopes that you're going to go out there and be like, you're not going to believe this. I've got the answer to all this. But really what you did is you put it out there and you were like, right away, hey, this could be disinformation, folks. And you know, it was kind of self-defeating,
you know,
in a way, but on their part, in a sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you always have to be careful how you write about when you present a story. You know, I don't want people to think, you know, I was dismissing the story or endorsing it. You know, I was just telling the story of the group as it existed and how and why they came to their conclusions. But, you know, I'm not some sort of wide-eyed, slack-jawed, oh my God, you know, just swallows everything that comes along. I don't mind relating, you know, unless somebody says to me, I really don't want you to publish what I'm about to tell you. And I truthfully don't, you know, if somebody says that. But otherwise, if, you know, if I'm given a story and somebody's okay about publishing it, I'll do it. But if I don't believe the story, I'm going to say, you know, I was given this story, just, you know, read it, it's crazy. Or read it because it's interesting, but be aware that I'm not sure, even as the person telling it, you know, if we can verify it or if it's real. I think provided you do that and you're honest about the reasons why you're relating the story and what it could mean or what it couldn't mean, you're not going to fall in the pitfall of endorsing disinformation. You know, you could argue that the Majestic 12 documents are disinformation, but nobody really ever wrote about them from the perspective of being disinformation. The debunkers said it's just some guy in his basement, you know, with an old typewriter. And the UFO researchers said it's vindication for Roswell. Very few people said, well, maybe, yeah, Roswell did happen, but this is just designed to confuse things even more, you know. And that's what I tried to do with the Collins elite story, was say, well, yeah, it's coming from the government, but let's not just... you know, go running to psychiatrists with nervous breakdowns in case it's true. But let's not dismiss it. Let's just try and figure out what's going on by telling the story. You know?
Right, right, exactly. Well, we need more level-headed sort of, we need more of that level-headed perspective on this, because that might be the only way we're really going to...
Well, yeah, the more controversial something is, the more of a level head rather than a screaming, shrill voice you got to have, because that don't do anybody any good, you know, screaming that the world's going to end.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Now, I got a couple of general sort of questions for you, just since like we haven't talked in so long. You know, we did the year in review episodes quite a bit, a couple times now, and I'd had the one with Greg this past year as well, and it's followed the sort of pattern where it's moved further and further away from the stories of the year and just sort of bemoaning what I've called the malaise of ufology. This sort of struck me as I was reading the pyramids and the Pentagon with the section on crop circles, but it feels like really that we're in like a paranormal stasis at this point. Mm. It feels like it's not just UFOs. I mean, there's a lot of really compelling crop circles that have happened this summer, but they're not like setting the world on fire. It's an interesting sort of thing that we're in right now. I mean, what do you think of that? I know a lot of people say, well, you know, Benal, you've been doing this for 10 years. You're jaded about all this stuff. But I still think that that can't be the case, or it's not the case. Because, like, if you look back on the 80s and the 90s, there were bigger events. But now it just seems like there's this stasis, as I said, this paranormal stasis that's gone on for a while. But, I mean,
well, no,
you know.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Tim. Because, you know, you go back to the 50s. You know, I mean, even the UFO researchers were getting by the dozen every year, radar reports, pilot encounters. You look at, like, Keogh's books, you know, from the early 50s, jammed with just stuff going on everywhere. You know, South America, landing trace cases, aliens taking soil samples, you know, dogfights over Washington, D.C. Today, it's just like a bunch of YouTube footage, which could go either way, you know,
right,
real or some kid, you know, face full of spots, doing something in the basement or whatever, you know, with the latest bit of software. It's like the classic cases have gone, and it's almost like, you know, ufology has become obsessed with the classic cases because we aren't getting classic cases anymore.
Right.
You know, it's like a lot of ufology has been reduced to turf wars of just still arguing over Socorro or Roswell. You know, I understand they're intriguing and potentially very important cases, but, you know, 50 years after Socorro, almost 65 years after Roswell, as a movement, we should really be trying to take the future further and the present, not just still arguing over how many bodies were found at Roswell.
Yeah,
that doesn't take away the significance of it. But you're right. I think in today's world, you know, you can go back to the 80s, you know, when the Majestic 12 documents surfaced, you know, again, regardless what people think about and regardless what people think about Gulf Breeze, Bob Lazar, there was a tremendous push and a popularity and, you know, things going on. And ironically, the subject today is more visible, but less is happening. It's like, you know, there's countless TV shows on UFOs, reality TV shows, but to use an English for phrase, they're total bollocks.
Yeah.
You know, reality TV, I mean, if I have to see another group of people running around a haunted house, a wood, a forest, or some old military place saying, what the hell was that at midnight with night scope equipment, you know, I think I'll blow my head off my shoulders, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Because, but the ironic thing is, there's a saturation of paranormal shows, but nothing's going on in them.
Right.
You know, it's like investigating Bigfoot. Oh, well, we'll go out at night where we can't see anything. You know, Bigfoot's real, it's still around in the day, you know.
Exactly. You're probably more apt to find it, it's probably sleeping.
Yeah. Yeah, why go out to investigate a UFO hotspot when it's pitch black? Well, the reason they do it is because night scope footage looks atmospheric. And these shows aren't about solving mysteries or investigating stuff. They're about creating entertainment. And the problem is, one of the reasons why ufology is in such doldrums is because investigative work is being replaced by entertainment. And when that happens, it just causes disaster. You know, we need to get back to the grassroots, but the other problem is we're not getting those grassroots classic reports anymore. It's like the phenomenon has changed as well. You know, not just ufology hasn't just changed in terms of being the medium of this or that. the cases and the phenomena itself has altered its, the way it sort of manifests and whatever. I mean, even abductions, you know, they aren't on, reported on the scale as they were in, say, the 80s.
Right.
You know, when it was like a, it was almost like a plague, you know, it was like a zombie virus. Everybody was infected, you know, by abductions.
Right, right. Like, that's kind of the line I was drawn to the yeah. crop circle thing. And then you can go to, like, cattle mutilations. I mean, I'm sure they're still happening, but they're not, I don't know, it hasn't crossed some line of
oh,
newness.
God, well, I mean, when I, you know, I, as you know, I'm originally from England, I can remember 1989, 1991, when crop circles were literally the main story on the BBC News.
Wow.
I mean, with, you know, when the whole thing with Colin Andrews and, you know, was at its height, you know, it was a mainstream BBC News. This formation's been found. And there was like this cultural time, like a peak for a while where everybody in the nation was just, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen? You know, is this it? You know, are the aliens going to land? And that's not a joke or an exaggeration. You know, kind of like when an entire culture briefly gets behind something. It was like that.
Right.
But today now, oh yeah, more crop circles, you know, it's good for the tourists and there'll be nice colour photographs splashed across, you know, this newspaper or that newspaper. And it's just become, that's what it is. You know, it's the wonderment, if you like, has gone. And maybe it's part of it is just the jadedness of people, you know, seen it before, done it before, whatever, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
I think part of it is that. But I think equally, you know, it's like maybe some of these phenomena, whatever they are, have given up on us.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's I've said that on the show before where I've likened the UFO phenomenon to like an ex-girlfriend where it's like, you know, we had some good times.
You want to stay in touch. You want to do the right thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's – I mean, joking aside, maybe to put it bluntly – you know, maybe that there was a period when whatever this phenomenon is has tried to get us to do the right thing, and we've constantly screwed up. You know, we're destroying the planet. People are getting unhealthier and bigger. You know,
yeah.
Pollution's getting worse. There's deforestation, and maybe in alien terms, somebody has just literally said "fuck 'em." You know,
yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that is what's happened, and what we're seeing now is just the residual after effects of some phenomenon that bit by bit is slowly
leaving,
going away, leaving,
yeah.
Whatever, you know, and occasionally it stays around or somebody thinks, you know, the equivalent of, well, I'll give him a try for the next couple of months. And they're like, fine, you're on your own. We're going, you know?
Right, right, right. Like monthly checkups or like annual checkups or, you know,
yeah. And then they become bi-monthly and then yearly. And then it's like, well, you know, the infestation's spreading. Sorry. There's no, you know, it's like the equivalent. We can't do any more chemotherapy for you, you know. We're very sorry, but.
Right.
You know, you shouldn't have smoked for 50 years or whatever, you know.
I'm doing my best to quit. I'm doing my best, Nick.
No, good man.
Now, what about the other thing, just on a wholly sort of broad perspective, because I think I like to look at these sort of things on a big scale. I find it kind of interesting. Here we are, it's the long-awaited 2012, and even 2012 has sort of gone to the back burner. I'm sure it'll ramp up as we get towards December, but it's interesting. Everyone was all worked up about 2012, but I haven't heard too much about it this year. Maybe everyone's just sort of trepidatious about what's going to happen.
Well, I think, unfortunately, in today's world, it's very easy to frighten people, you know, and people do, you know, get hysterical and whatever, but, you know, people also have a short attention span, so it's like when it goes away, they forget about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like bird flu. I mean, I never got inoculated with bird flu. I had people around me said, oh, the nation's, yeah, everybody's going to get bird flu, we're all going to die. And I said, well, fine, go and queue up at the nearest pharmacy and get your bird flu injection. Who remembers that now? Everybody's forgotten about it, all those doomsday stories. You know, and I think that's like 2012. And it probably will, and I'm sure it'll resurface the closer and closer we get to December the 21st. But, you know, I don't think anything's going to happen. And I think by December the 21st of the next year, it'll be as forgotten as Y2K. But people are easy to whip up into a frenzy when it is big news.
Yeah.
But equally, they quickly forget as well. So.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how all this unfolds. And you know, to go back to that idea of the paranormal stasis, you know, like I said earlier, I got to give you credit because you're putting out fresh stuff. You're putting out, you know, stuff that hasn't really been done before.
To. Yeah, I mean, if truthfully, I'm not just saying this. If, you know, I was thinking about a new idea for a book and I couldn't find anything new, specifically new to write about, I would never go down the path of doing, you know, a roundup of the top 50 famous abduction stories, you know, do 5 pages regurgitated from somebody's book on Betty and Barney Hill and then five pages on the Andreessen case or whatever, or Whitley Strieber, where it's all been published before, because there's just no point. You know, if you're going to write a book, it's like you with a radio show. You want to get guests on who've got something fresh and new to say. You know, yeah, it's great to have somebody who's been in the field 50 years and who gives you all their background, you know, and you do a sort of like paying homage to them type show. That's cool. But I'm sure you wouldn't want just a show that is a roundup of everything we know about this case or that case for 2 hours. You know, it's pointless.
Exactly.
So, you know, one of my criteria has always been whether people agree with me or not, or like me or not. I don't really care, you know, but I do try and put out new data, you know, whether people agree with it or not, because what's the point of doing it otherwise? You know, it's just, there is no point.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you kind of hit what we've been doing here on the show. People always seem to link me to UFOs, but if you look at the archive, we haven't really done too many UFO shows like in the last couple of years because it's, you know, as I said earlier.
Because you've got so much else new to talk about.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Now, speaking of new, what you said you get the new book coming out around Halloween. What do you have on the horizon? Not just this year, but, you know, in the future.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, that one, The World's Weirdest Places, comes out sort of October time, which is a, you know, study of my favorite sort of top 25 paranormal hotspots around the planet. And then I've also done one for Patrick Wege's Anomalies books, which is called Monster Diary. That'll be, I think that might be out before the end of the year as well. It's basically, you know, I do write my cryptozoological books very different to, you know, things like Final Events or Body Snatchers, which is just like a straightforward relating of the facts. But because, you know, the crypto stuff I do, the monster hunting, is all on the road stuff, I write it as like a road trip style.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of hit the road at midnight, you know, and drove down this foggy road in search of whatever. You know, I like to write it as it actually happened. So that one will be out, Monster Diary, I think probably before the end of the year. Definitely not before The World's Weirdest Places. That would be too much overkill, even even for me. You know, people would be like, just go away for a while. And I wouldn't blame them. You know, even I wouldn't blame them for saying that. But yeah, but that'll be out after that, I think, possibly round about the end of the year. Then I'm working on another crypto book for, again, I'm not sure when that'll be out, but I think into 2013. That's called Wild Man, and that's going to be published in Britain. It's all about Bigfoot and Wild Man type reports from Britain, which there are actually a surprisingly massive amount of reports, but most of them have sort of paranormal aspects to them, or 14 aspects. And so it addresses a subject, again, that's not really been the subject of a book before, Bigfoot in Britain.
Yeah.
So that'll be out, and then really weirdly, like you said, I was actually being given a lot of consideration to the idea of a book about what the government knows about these so-called cryptid animals.
Yeah, I would love
that. And I'm also working on a book which, you know, I've done these two Men in Black books, On the Trail of the Saucer Spies and The Real Men in Black, it actually prompted a lot of people to come forward with their own Men in Black stories, which had never been published before. And you know, everybody who was willing to have their stories published has now sort of given their permission, and they're all speaking on the record. Nobody's speaking off the record or whatever.
Nice.
And so I'm doing a book which is basically a collection of the stories in their own words. No interruptions from me, but then with like a comment section afterwards, like a comment/analysis thing of each case from me. So it's like case one, case two, then Nick's analysis of the case. You know, there's something like 50 or 60 when I say brand new, I mean some of them are old, but just never been discussed before. But in that sense, you know, sort of 50, 60 brand new MIB cases, you know, spanning the 40s to the present day, literally.
Nice.
You know, and trying to, this will be sort of the third MIB book I've done, which I think I might make these an ongoing thing because I'm quite interested in all the MIB stuff. And there's certainly enough material, you know, to sort of, again, if I bring something fresh to, you know, keep trying to dig into who these MIB are. So.
Awesome, awesome. So you got a lot going on. I'm looking forward to it. And like
yeah,
I said,
so always the blogging and, you know, articles for websites and that sort of stuff, lecturing. I'm speaking at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis in October. And this month I've got September I've got two lectures. One for a Dallas-based group called the Extraordinary Phenomenal Investigations Council, EPIC. That'll be the third weekend in September. Then the last weekend, the Saturday night, I'm speaking at the Austin Center for Spiritual Living in Austin, Texas, on pyramids and the Pentagon. So there'll be those two in September, the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis in October, where there'll actually be a lot of sort of ancient astronaut people, like Eric Von Daniken speaking there.
Yeah, that's a big event. That's definitely a big event.
Marie Jones will be there. Larry Flaxman, you know, they did, Marie did the 2012 book. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there'll be a lot of interesting lectures, I think. So.
Yeah, yeah. If I had any money, I'd be there. But
well, maybe they'll cover it if you say you're going to promote it and whatever. You never
know. That's true. I don't see how much it costs to fly to Minneapolis, but maybe it can be done. Well, I can't thank you enough, Nick. Like I said at the beginning, you know, it's been way too long since I had you on the program for a pure paranormal discussion, and it's not going to be another 5 years before we do it again because there's just so much stuff to cover. That I just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and the time flew by. That's all I can tell. It's been a good show. It's like already been over 2 hours, and I'm just stunned by that.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tim. I had a good time. I mean, we could cover a lot of ground, you know, and a lot of areas and sort of demystified a lot of stuff and, you know, covered a lot of paradigms and ideas. And I'll have to try and get back out to your area as well at some point and come and hang out for some of that good beer again.
Absolutely. Absolutely, my friend. The Pyramids and the Pentagon, that's from New Page Books. Final Events is from Anomalous Books. And there's just, as we've said over the course of this conversation, tons and tons more books by Nick Redfern. Folks, go out and pick them up. You will love them. Thank you once again for coming on the show, Nick.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Nick Redfern for coming back on the show and giving us so much time. Be sure to check out the two books which we discussed here on the program this week, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, as well as Final Events. And if you want to know more about Nick Redfern, head on over to his website, www.nickredfernfortian.blogspot.com. Pretty simple, all one word, nickredfernfortian.blogspot.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and we've got four quick messages here from the BOA Audio listeners, so let's dive on in. First one comes from Sandra in Liverpool, England, and here's what she has to say. Just a quick message to say a big thank you for your fantastic interviews. I have had my eyes opened over the years, and your podcast is right up there at the top of my faves. I love your technique, and you impress me when you don't force your opinion, which must be hard sometimes, but you do a really great job. Thanks, Sandra in Liverpool, England. Well, thank you, Sandra, for writing in. Much appreciated and really humbling kudos on the program. I am very thankful for your kind words. Part of the reason why I picked this email here, beyond the fact that Sandra was writing to us from Liverpool, England, and you all know I love the international listeners, was her thoughts on my technique and how I don't force my opinion on the listeners or the guest. That is, of course, a conscious decision on my part. You'd be amazed how many people I meet who want to know what I really think of all this stuff, want to know my thoughts on a whole bunch of different paranormal mysteries, and confess that they cannot decipher it from listening to the program. I take a great deal of pride in that, because it is my job really to get the guest on here and have them present their work and have the listeners decide. I don't want to sway people's opinion on the veracity of the guest's material. Although I think people who've been listening a long enough time will be able to really kind of figure out where I stand on a number of issues. But there are plenty which sit in my gray basket, and I'm just willing to sort of give it the benefit of the doubt and wait to see whether it's proven right or wrong. I just really enjoy the mystery aspect of all this, and trying to get to the bottom of it is the goal of the program, but at the same time, the journey is as much the reward as is the final answers. Next email comes from Joshua. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I have a theory about irrational fear of clowns. I believe that the reason some adults have an irrational fear of clowns is because they were abducted as children. I remember some researchers saying that aliens would mask themselves as a child-loving image to remove fear. I believe clowns are being used by the abductors. However, after so many abductions, the child becomes afraid of clowns, as they have always led to a terrifying experience, a fear they cannot understand, but very real. What do you think of this, Joshua? I don't know what to think of that, Joshua. That's an interesting theory, although I'm skeptical in a sense, because clowns really are kind of creepy in and of themselves. Just looking at them and their bizarre face paint kind of puts a chill down many people's spines, whether they've been abducted or not. I suppose aliens disguising themselves as clowns to abduct children has probably happened in the past, but I'm not sure it's as rampant as you kind of put forward here in this hypothesis, because I think we probably would have more anecdotes or revelations about this clown abduction theory, and I've never really heard it put forward in a big way by anybody in the abduction research community, which of course is already fraught with all sorts of problems in and of itself. It's certainly something worth considering. It's definitely something that's given me pause and had me take a second look at clowns, which I never thought I'd be doing. But as I said, I don't think it's as rampant as you think, but anything's possible. Probably more in this modern age, I'd think that aliens would be disguising themselves as whatever little kids are into nowadays, because clowns are really antiquated, and they're not as big as they were in the 50s and 60s, for sure. So maybe nowadays the clowns are disguising themselves, as I said, as figures in children's entertainment beyond clowns. But definitely something worth considering, and those are my thoughts on it, and I'd be interested in hearing what the BOA Audio listeners think about this clown theory. And, of course, thank you for writing in, Joshua. Next email comes from Marty in Paisley, Scotland. Here's what he has to say. Just started catching up with Season 7. Wow, great shows. The Cruise Line episode was definitely disturbing. I, like you, was getting mad listening to the outrageous crimes that are being committed aboard these ships, and have to ask why the governments of the countries where these victims come from are not actively acting on the victims' families' behalf to give them closure, but instead seem to be turning the other cheek. I wonder if a government's official was a victim, would there be any other outcome other than what was stated on the show? Outrageous. Again, great shows. Keep up the great standard and content. Marty from Paisley, Scotland. Thank you for writing in, Marty. I think, based on what Kendall Carver was telling us on the program a few episodes ago, it definitely seems like the U.S. government is stonewalling getting behind investigating these crimes. There certainly seems to be evidence that that is the case. Around the world, however, I think countries like the UK and Australia, I think perhaps their government officials are in turn being stonewalled by the cruise ship companies. There is really quite a disconnect between these ships out at sea and the folks on the land, where you really got to get to the bottom of these crimes very quickly. And that disconnect, as well as the purposeful stonewalling by the cruise ship industry, opens up a huge vacuum of time where perpetrators of these crimes quite simply just get away with what they've done. There's a big problem, as Kendall Carver said on the program, and it's still resonating here with the listeners, as evidenced by what Marty has said. And as far as if a government official's family was a victim, I'm sure we'd see a very different approach to this whole issue. But ironically enough, doesn't it always seem like governments' families never are victims of these bizarre crimes or disappearances or strange happenings? You never hear of a government official's son or daughter being abducted by an alien or go missing in a national park. These things simply just do not happen to them. I don't know what that's all about, but it's definitely something worth considering. Thank you again, of course, for writing in, Marty, from Paisley, Scotland. And the final message this week comes from Flapdoodle in Austin, Texas, and this was posted on our BOA Facebook page. And here's what Flapdoodle has to say. Haunted objects? I need to listen again. I think Robert the Doll did something to me during his segment. The last thing I remember when listening is the mention of his name. His? OMG, now I'm doing it. Flapdoodle in Austin, Texas. Kind of a funny one there to wrap things up. That was posted on the Banal of America Facebook page. Please allow me to plug it here before I respond to Flapdoodle. Head on over to Facebook, punch in Banal of America. We've got an official page there. If you have not yet and you want to and can, please like us on Facebook. We're trying to get to 1,000 likes. And as I reflected on during last week's program, there really is no reward for 1,000 likes. It's just a moronic milestone to aim for. Nonetheless, head on over to Banal of America on Facebook and like us. With regards to what Flapdoodle has to say, I really don't have much of a response to that, although I presume that he or she enjoyed the program. I was really spooked out by that episode, to be quite honest with you. I enjoyed it quite a bit, but after I hung up the phone, after talking to Chris and Tim, I was a little just chilled by how strange some of that stuff was. It's one thing to be pestered by a ghost. You can kind of put your finger on it, even though it is pretty bizarre and odd that you got to deal with a ghost haunting you. But if it's an object, how do you even deal with that? That's the weird part. And Robert the Doll and the story of the persistently haunted poster board that had the bloody Our Father on it. Just creepy stuff. Really creepy stuff. I hope that you did go back to listen to the program again, Flapdoodle, and beware of Robert the Doll. Treat him with respect, and he will protect you. Disrespect him, and he will curse you. Creepy stuff, folks. And on that note, we'll zip up the BOA Audio Listener Feedback mailbag for this week. Big thanks to Flapdoodle in Austin, Texas for writing in. Thanks to Marty from Paisley, Scotland for writing in. Thanks to Joshua and Sandra in Liverpool, England for also writing in. If you'd like to be a part of future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, there are a number of ways to get in touch with me. You can simply head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, ofamerica.com, and click the contact button, or write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. And if you want something a little more interactive, there are two highly interactive ways to get in touch with me. You can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. That is BOA's Paranormal Playground, our official message board where we talk about the world of the paranormal as well as pop culture. And additionally, if you want some interactive goodness, join up at the official BOA page on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America and you'll find it on there very quickly and easily. And, of course, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so feel free to search out Banal and befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And now, please allow me to pause and give thanks to the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Since the last time you heard from me, I have yet to post new columns from the BOA staff, but I am sitting on an all-new Trickster's Realm from Regan Lee, as well as an all-new Esotericana from Tina Senna. Those will be posted at Banal of America later on this week, so be sure to head on over to BOA for additional insights from the BOA staff. BOA, make it a part of your search for esoteric news and opinion. Now comes the time in the program where I turn to you, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, and ask you to help us out via a donation to the BOA franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. There are two ways to do so. You can head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. It's on the left-hand side of the screen. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But what if you don't trust the internet? What if you want to donate via snail mail? Well, you can do that, folks. You can send your donations to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you spell Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. The complete address can be found at Banal of America underneath the PayPal button. And if you mail us a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, because my bank is anal and will not cash those donations. And please include some form of correspondence so I can write you back and thank you for your donation. As always, it is worth noting here, folks, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, I meant to mention this at the beginning of this program, but we've got sort of a plan here as we roll through the rest of 2012. Let's say, for instance, the world is going to end on December 21st, 2012. What's the best way, really, to get us prepared for that? That is to welcome back some of the classic guests from the program, longtime friends of the show, starting with this week's program here with Nick Redfern, going all the way through 2012, bringing back some old friends of the show. So on the next edition of the program, it's only frighteningly 2 short weeks away from Thanksgiving, which means it's time once again for our now annual holiday tradition known as Rucksgiving, where we welcome back the extremely popular Bruce Rucks to BOA Audio. Of course, we had Bruce on in July for what was a somber and solemn edition of the program, talking about the Aurora shootings. This time around, it's going to be much lighter as we bring Bruce on the program for a jam session covering the world of the esoteric, covering UFOs, covering all sorts of stuff. I could tell you more, but I haven't even taped the episode yet. Probably going to tape it next week. But I have gotten confirmation from Bruce that he is in for Rucksgiving 2012. So that will be the next edition of the program. And since I'm talking to the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, I'll give you a little teaser for what's to come in the weeks leading up to the end of 2012. We're going to be welcoming back longtime friends of the show, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, for a mind-bending edition of the program talking about time travel. And we'll also have another longtime friend of the show, Paul Kimball, talking about his new book, The Other Side of Truth. And by the time you hear those two episodes, again, frighteningly enough, it will be time for the holidays. So we'll be having, I hope, the legendary Stan Friedman on for our annual holiday special, and our good buddy Greg Bishop for the Year in Review wrap-up. If you're someone who wants to hear new guests, you want to hear fresh folks on the program, do not be dismayed, because I've already lined up a bunch of amazing guests for the beginning of 2013 and going forward. So we're going to have a lot of old friends here on the show as we wrap up the year. And then once 2013 kicks off, we're going to have some truly tremendous folks on the program to help us get the new year started in a big way. So that's pretty much the state of the program here as we close out the year. Next week on the program, the amazing Bruce Rucks joins us for Rucksgiving 2012. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to Nick Redfern for coming on the show. Big thanks to Sandra in Liverpool, England, Joshua, Marty from Paisley, Scotland, and Flapdoodle in Austin, Texas for their contributions to BOA Audio listener feedback. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who tune in to the very end of the show. You guys are the best. Thank you for your enduring support of this program. It is truly humbling and tremendously appreciated. Thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.